My only like gift in life is persistence, really. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and maybe vulnerability to be prepared to fuck up and be honest about it. You know, like I had no idea what I was doing and I just had to ask people to help me. There was a certain magic and luck that came with that party idea that just people connected with and it felt right. Originally we went to City of Yarra and we said, hey, we know you guys are trying to go zero carbon by 2030. We want to help. And they were like, they wouldn't even give us a permit to do a street party. They kept on rejecting us. And then, and at this stage, we'd met some lovely crew from Melbourne who wanted to help us throw the party. So basically ended up finding the site at Acca. We never wanted it to be some hippie fest because we weren't trying to preach to the converted. We wanted to make it accessible for everyone. We wanted it to be aspirational. We wanted the leaders on the music scene. We didn't want it to be cheesy. Because we need this to be a progressive concept. We need it to be forward-thinking and aspirational, and it's the future. It's creative, it's futuristic, it's inevitable, it's happening. Like, let's fucking get on with it.
Hi, I'm Dan Brophy. Welcome to Quit Your Day Job, a podcast for frustrated creatives. My guest this week is Ross Harding. Ross is an environmentally conscious creative mastermind whose brainchild is the Off The Grid Festival. It's a solar-powered dance party that takes place right in the heart of the Melbourne CBD. It actually usually falls directly around the time of my birthday, so for the last couple of years, I've actually made it my birthday party. I am such a huge fan of Ross. Everything he does, the way his festival feels, from the acts to the sort of people that it attracts. You know, Ross's background is in engineering, and he found a way to combine his passion for eco-conservation with social change and his love of techno and having a great time. What started as just a day party in the Melbourne CBD, solar-powered, has evolved to encapsulate a festival of ideas, featuring Australia's leading environmentalists, architects, activists, entrepreneurs, and of course, being Melbourne, foodies. This is how you make environmental awareness cool. I wanted to talk to Ross all about how he went from working in the corporate space to starting his own festival, from conception to completion, and all the hurdles along the way. See, for Ross, this is just a small step on an ever-evolving journey to create real change in his local environment, but with a view to affect bigger change in the wider community and globally. The key, I realized in talking to Ross, is not to tell people what they should want, or even to tell them what they should do. The most effective thing to do to affect change is to give people what they already want, but to use it as a means to equip them with the tools to make better choices for themselves in future. If you're looking to stage a never-before-seen event, or you want to make work that's designed to shift people's perspectives, or you want to create social impact using skills developed through your 9-to-5, then this is a conversation for you. But before we start, can you do me a favor? Can I ask that you leave a review and you rate us in iTunes? If you haven't done it already, what's wrong with you? It's not like I don't ask you every week. Go on, do it now. I'll wait. Just hit pause. I'll be right here when you get back. Done? Great. Aren't you happy that you've done your bit to help other creatives in need of a digital hug and the pep talk that they need to see themselves through the drudgery of another day in a career that they have no idea how they got themselves into? Do you feel better? I do. Now, please enjoy my chat with Ross Harding from the Off The Grid Festival.
So, Ross, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
So, I love to start by asking people, hey, when someone says, what do you do, what do you tell them?
You know what? I actually have probably a different story for different people depending on who I'm speaking to. But
often the case.
Probably the most general summary is that I'm a peace-loving hippie of an engineer is probably like one way of explaining it. But I tend to, basically I work with the technical, financial and creative side of self-sufficiency on, like in relation to architecture, but in relation to cities.
And was that, what did you study to get there?
I did, I did mechanical engineering and finance in Adelaide. And then I went to Sweden and studied sustainable energy engineering.
Is that a Scandinavian specific offering?
Yeah, well, growing up in Adelaide, there wasn't a lot going on in environmental engineering. Actually not in Australia. Like UNSW had a PV, like solar power engineering course, but I couldn't really find anything in Australia to study what I wanted to learn. So I did MechEng, and then just when Sweden kind of just had all these amazing subjects happening, and I met some Swedes in Adelaide, and they just told me, you got to come to Stockholm and learn about it.
Great. Because you came into my periphery when I attended your Off the Grid event.
Yes.
For the first time in 2016, I think.
Yep, that'd be right.
And for those that don't know, and this is how it was pitched to me, it's a solar-powered dance party in the centre of Melbourne CBD.
Yep.
Is that a nice little soundbite?
Yeah. We talk about it as a cultural intervention dedicated to transforming the cities we live in.
Well, I think the reason why you had encountered me was because I was vlogging daily at the time,
right.
I did a little vlog from there because I was so blown away by what I was experiencing. And I think the thing that really turned me on was I've been living in Sydney the last 6 years, Off the Grid is down in Melbourne, and I was getting very frustrated at the time, just the lack of government enthusiasm around dance events. And I know, and I think I vlogged incorrectly, that I was really impressed by how supportive, you know, the local council had been to make this dance party that was an amazing dance party in the center of the city happen. And the fact that it had a sustainability element, and it was, you know, it was solar powered, and it was, you know, had so many good things going for it. And yet, it had such support from the city, whereas in Sydney, you know, it's like the opposite, where you're just struggling to be heard, let alone to be allowed to have something happen late at night in districts that have been party districts for generations.
Mm.
Yet here we are in the center of the business district having a day party dedicated to raising awareness, understanding around sustainability, but doing it in a way that will make people listen by giving them something that they really want.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was the nucleus of the idea that made you think about launching Off the Grid?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I kind of have to go back a little bit to where, like, to explain my work a little bit, because it kind of came out of that. Like, from Stockholm, I got a job with a guy who started the World Green Building Council. And he basically was working in Sydney. So I worked in Sydney for 3 years as a engineer, environmental consultant. And I worked on things like Central Park Sydney. I did the master plan of all the energy, water and waste strategy for that site.
Basically. Central Park Sydney is breathtaking. It is, I mean, I heard that the reason why it's so impressive architecturally is because it's like the flagship development for the company that makes it, and that they do developments all around the world, and that's one of the sites that they point to show what they're capable of achieving.
Yeah.
So when you go to, for those that don't know, when you go to Central Park Sydney, it's one of the few apartment development spaces that manages to be completely modern in Sydney, architecturally dynamic, have so much thought given to green spaces, communal spaces, yet it's also got Spice Alley, which is a place to affordably, you know, eat Pan-Asian cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the most breathtaking hanging garden that is suspended off the penthouse level of the of the center tower in the development. It's got a beautiful art house cinema. It's got really great. I mean, it's very popular with international students, and it's got such modern kind of international city feeling, but it doesn't feel like everyone's living in shoeboxes and having a shit time. It feels like it's really luxurious and beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's arguably one of the most sustainable city blocks in the world, okay? But I was involved for the first 2 years. So when there were just sketches and some like rectangular blobs on a drawing, do you know what I mean? And they had Norman Foster, an English architect, and Jean Nouvel working on it, and I'm a French architect. And basically, I was 22, and I was like just a graduate in the office, but I basically got to do everything on that project. So I spent 2 years researching and trying to implement every piece of technology I could find that would financially viably make the site self-sufficient. So try and power it entirely on renewable energy, try and make it operate in a completely zero waste fashion, try and make it operate in a completely water neutral fashion. And basically, long story short, we got about halfway there. But we proved that you could do 100% and make it financially viable. And what I realized was that it's not the technical and the financial barriers that is getting in the way of self-sufficient cities. It's the political and social barriers. And so at that point in time, I was a bit jaded. And I was also working on what was considered the greenest building in the world in Sydney, in Melbourne, called CH2. And the building was using three times more energy than the average office building for supposedly the greenest building in the world. And I realise there's a lot of talk in this industry and a lot of bullshit, basically. I hope I can swear on your
Please.
Podcast.
Go down.
And so I thought, you know what, I've got to try and, you know, like find other ways of using this information that I've learned to try and somehow speed things up, because we've got to try and create change quickly. So I basically got invited to do this sort of green MBA, and they picked 25 youngsters in Melbourne and Sydney. It was called Centre for Sustainability Leadership, from carbon tax lawyers to Greenpeace activists to engineers to architects, you know, you name it. Anyone from any area that was either socially or environmentally interested in sustainability put us together. They like come up with a crazy project. And so my project was to try and power the entire world using only renewable energy. And I looked into it and I was like, what's the barriers? You know, what are the issues? And same deal. I kind of got to the point, well, it's technically possible to power the whole world using only renewables. And it's, you know, it's financially viable, you know, like it sort of, it really does stack up financially if you just look at the whole system. But it came down to political and social barriers that are stopping us. So I thought, okay, so I'm not really all that, you know, skilled up in politics. So I know people though, like I like people. I've always partied, I've always been a social person, I've always sort of, you know, like had lots of friends and like to kind of, you know, cruise around and cause trouble with all kinds of people. And so I started thinking, how could I take the information I'd learned and communicate it to people? I figured if you could make this information digestible to anybody, then if everyone understood it, we would just make it happen much faster. So parallel to this, I was about to move to London with my work. They were asking me to move to London and start up an office over there with them. And what I did was I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to go visit renewable power plants as a sort of way of communicating these solutions. So we bought a Mercedes-Benz, converted it to run vegetable oil, drove it from Adelaide up to Sydney on veggie oil with a film crew. Visited a biogas plant, a solar plant. We visited a geothermal power plant. We visited a hydroelectric power plant. We visited all these different power plants, filmed them. And we thought we could make this really fun, entertaining content because, you know, we thought we were really funny guys and all this sort of stuff. And the content was shit boring, you know, like, and it was, you know, I realized how hard it was to make this important information digestible for people.
Did you hear that, clients? What I give you is gold. You just think it happens?
Exactly. No, so, and this is the thing, like, so, you know, it was me and as an engineer and actually my now partner on the festival, Ayo Halamish, who's a political kind of activist. He does digital democracy. He works with community engagement and in the environmental space and a whole bunch of different stuff. So he and I were doing this road trip and we started this thing up and called it Finding Infinity, which was about finding solutions to a future based on infinite resources rather than trying to sort of combat problems like climate change. We wanted to try and demonstrate that you could transition the world to be based on resources that don't run out, basically. So instead of everyone looking at climate change a problem, we need to do things that are not based on carbon. Let's go to something like nuclear. Nuclear has its own problems, you know what I mean? And it's like, so in effect, we wanted people thinking about this, you know, infinite loop, closing the loop, making things run forever, yeah? So, and also the thing with Finding Infinity was, it was about not being perfect and not knowing the answer, but searching for it with people and taking people on that journey. So we sort of went separate ways and I went to London and he stayed here and he started up his business, which has sort of became a really successful tech startup. I went to London and I was working on competitions around the world with like firms like Zaha Did, Rem Koolhaas, really important architecture firms. and just doing pitches and concepts to try and win these amazing architectural competitions all over the world, and like working on like huge towers in China and amazing developments in Tripoli, and just got jaded by it again, because I was just doing these competitions. If we won the competition, we weren't really going to follow through with these things anyway, and I was just feeling limited by the barriers of this big 10,000 person engineering firm that I was working in. And saying that, you know, also like I'm a fairly, you know, at school, my two favorite subjects were maths and art. And it was like, in an engineering firm, you're not really supposed to be all that creative. You know what I mean? It's like the architects are supposed to be the ones being creative, and engineers are the ones supposed to do the numbers to justify what the architects are doing. So I was always a bit of an unusual guy in an engineering firm. But that time in London, I ended up volunteering at a music festival. And it was for a solar charity called SolarAid. And they were basically charging mobile phones on solar power to raise money for communities in Africa to send over renewable power, like solar power plants, to these communities. And so me and a whole crew of friends all went on a bus, and we just basically like went and helped out and had heaps of fun. We're dancing around trying to like get people to charge their phones, and we ended up, you know, like it was called the Big Chill Festival. We had a really fun time. It was like the English Do Festival as well. I don't know if you've been to them before.
Oh yeah, they sort of took what had maybe originated in other parts of Western Europe and kind of put it through the British PR machine.
Yeah.
And they probably made festivals explode in a way that's allowed them to become part of the mainstream now.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a really fun, like, I actually thought it was a really beautiful festival. And we, but through that, my friend and I still felt it was a bit tacky, you know, like it's so environmentally, things are still so, you know, it's either too technical or too environmental, and people just jam it down people's throats environmentally, you know, you need to use solar power, go vegan, you know, it's like, it's kind of a bit intense, you know what I mean? It's a bit preachy. And so my friend and I were just like, you know, this is cool that we got this solar system here, but like we should do something more fun with it. And we're like, why don't we just throw a solar powered techno party? And so I had turntables at my house. And my friend helped me try and get access to the equipment. So we basically decided to throw this solar powered party in my basement in London. And it was basically, but we really tried to do it authentically. So we basically didn't want to drive the batteries around town. So the batteries are in South London. We're charging them on the rooftop in South London. We got one of those old Danish bikes, filled up the Danish bike with batteries, drove them to my place in Hackney in London, put them in the basement, threw down this killer party. We basically like shut down the power in my house, just had only candlelight around the house, built a battery bank in front of the turntables, and everyone had such a good time. Like it was this amazing feeling, and it was just, you know, such a good party. We weren't expecting it to be that great. And we filmed the whole process as well, because we wanted to make it an invitation for the next party that we were doing. But at some point in time, because it was the first one, it was this trial, and the power cut out, and someone came up to me and he was like, hey man, did you have to plug into the wall? And I was like, yeah, we did. But you know, like it was just a trial. Like, you know, I don't mind it. It was a nice like experiment. And he was like, oh man, no, like you got no idea. Like, man, the music sounds so much better when it comes from the sun. And, you know, he probably had a few drinks, but that was what we were looking for. You know, it wasn't like, how big does the solar system need to be? What I'd studied and what I'd learned and what I was a professional in, like, not, you know, how big is it? How much does it cost? How much space does it require? How much energy will it generate? Like, screw the details. Like, we sort of accidentally started marketing solutions without selling them. Do you know what I mean? And so, and to be honest, like, it was that feeling that we created that I didn't expect or know, and it was just this accident that we came across. So from there, we threw another one in a Thai restaurant just across the river, got a pontoon, got a whole bunch of different musicians coming, and everyone loved it, and we raised about £1,000 for that charity, SolarAid. And then it kind of went from there. We ended up organizing another one in, so what happened? We did one in Mexico. So I moved to, so then I quit my job in London was like, you know what, screw this. I'm going to go work with another story that was going on was I was in touch with a Mexican guy who was a filmmaker. His name's Alfonso Garrido. And he was making wildlife documentaries in Mexico. And so he just sort of said, hey, man, I've seen this video you made with this party. I think it's time. Like, just come over. Let's start doing stuff together. So I just quit my job. I gave away everything I owned, like pretty much. I mean, I basically like had all these suits and I sent home like a box of records and a box of different bits and pieces and pretty much took like a skateboard with me and a bag and everything else I just offloaded and bought a ticket on a cargo ship because I didn't want to fly. And I moved to Mexico, just not really. I bought a camera. I filmed my trip from London to Mexico and I got there. And I didn't really know what to do. I was like, okay, cool. What am I going to do while I'm here? We were trying to pitch for funding to try and do this trip the whole way around the world using only renewable energy to promote solutions. And we basically got there. And so I thought, you know, what else am I going to do? I'll just throw another party. So we basically borrowed some solar panels and some batteries. And we ended up doing this party at sunrise in Mexico. And simultaneously, my brother threw one at Rooftop in Melbourne.
Mm. So this is your brother interested in the same?
My brother's an architect and he is also a DJ. And like, yeah, he loves parties. And he basically, you know, like, yeah, he was pumped about the idea. So we did it. We're trying to tee up four countries. We're trying to UK, Norway, Mexico and Melbourne. But we only got Mexico and Melbourne to work. And yeah, so I did sunrise, he did sunset, and his party was probably heaps better than ours was, actually. I mean, they were both great parties, but he threw a really kick-ass party in Melbourne. And so in the meantime, I met some hotel guy, like a really amazing hotel group called Design Hotels, and they saw these videos that we're making, and then simultaneously, some guy that I knew through AL, called Nick Francis, he was doing the world's biggest energy efficiency campaign in Mexico. So we met and he said, what are you up to? Like, what are you doing at the moment? We met in Mexico City. I pulled out the one suit that I still owned and like pretended like I wasn't homeless. Basically, I had no money when I was in Mexico. I basically like pretended like I was, you know, doing okay. And I see, he said, what are you up to? And I was like, I'm trying to get money from the British Council to do a pilot for this documentary I want to make to travel around the world promoting solutions. And he was like, how much do you need? And I was like, 30 grand. And he was like, I'll give you 25.
I want to make you work for a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he gave me 25 grand. We bought a truck and a motorbike that ran on veg oil. And we drove around Mexico visiting renewable power plants. But this time I got a German friend of mine to come over and help me make the films.
There's an awareness around the importance of documenting and content that's been there since the beginning.
Mm.
And I imagine that that's been a very great way to find new supporters as you go, because you've got this trail of all of the, you're not just saying you've done the thing, people can see it for themselves in the proof that you've documented the process along the way. Where did that awareness come from?
It's a good question. I mean, I guess I knew it needed to be human, you know, like it kind of came from real acknowledging the barriers to the transition and going like, well, actually there's that many reports out there and there's that many, like there's enough technical financial justification for this stuff. There's built projects all over the world that are doing this, but actually there's no humans connecting with this, you know. It's like, how do you connect the humans with the technology? So film was our, like film and events was really out that mechanism, and I just didn't know any better. I was trying social, you know, like I do social media, but you know, like it was all kind of not very successful, but we were just trying, you know what I mean?
Because a lot of the time there have been things that have, the party that started in the basement,
mm-hmm.
the fact that that took place, even though it was just a punt on something that you thought felt great,
mm.
stumbling into what you did, and just sort of trusting your instincts to guide you into that meant that when you went to do another one, not only are you bringing that awareness of what worked and what didn't work, but you also have a greater level of trust from those who've been paying attention. So it's almost like incrementally you build. I mean, I'm assuming that that all of these steps were crucial to be able to throw a gigantic party in the center of the Melbourne CBD that was entirely solar powered. To me, it just sounded so ambitious that you think,
Where did it come from?
Yeah. How are they? Who do they think they are? Yeah. Where do they get the gall to be able to think of the idea, let alone not just have it as this great potential? Because you and I both know a lot of people who would have had great ideas that they've never acted upon.
Exactly. So this is the thing. And you know, like, if you like, I'll keep going with the story. Please, yes. But it was just a succession of failures. You know what I mean? Like, that's all. My only like gift in life is persistence, really. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and maybe vulnerability to be prepared to fuck up and be honest about it. Do you know what I mean? And I mean, this is me deep in a communications campaign as an engineer, you know, like I had no idea what I was doing and I just had to ask people to help me. But I didn't set out to be creative about it or making films, or I was just interested in the purpose, you know, like I wanted to create change. And so I guess basically, yeah, like, and you're right. I mean, these different steps along the way help people follow us. Well, that was the idea. We wanted people to follow the journey. And so different, you're right. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It sort of had slowly been incrementally building. And so the thing we ended up doing a New Year's Eve party in Mexico with Carter Holzig, Bar 25 out of Germany. The solar system actually blew up. I wired it myself. I don't normally wire things and like normally get an electrician in, and I wired it myself and I wired it wrong and it blew up. And so that night we had to pull out a generator, unfortunately. So, you know, like this is the thing. It's taken a lot of fuck ups to get to the point where we can like smoothly power a party on solar these days. And so what we did was I spent 2 years in Mexico. And I was doing a whole bunch of different things, but mainly it was like we were preparing actually for this campaign around Germany. So the hotel group, they own 250 hotels around the world, or not, they represent 250 hotels around the world. It's called Design Hotels. So pretty slick hotels all over the world, particularly in Europe, were owned by like part of this group. And Design Hotels, yeah, it's kind of like maybe the most aspirational hospitality hotel group in the world. And these guys that own all the hotels are very influential cats in the neighborhoods of all the hotels. And so the CEO was like, hey, come and do what you're doing with us. And I felt like at first I'm caving in, you know, this is like some luxury brand. I was bought a motorbike and I was about to drive through South America and try and do these solar powered parties and build them up and do it this renegade, you know, like in your face.
That's like an eco Che Guevara.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, whatever. I was trying to change the world, you know, and I was like, I was trying to get people to sponsor this campaign. And then, so in Germany, we ended up we worked with about 30 hotels and we probably made about 35 different films visiting the heroes in the neighborhoods of the hotels and making 5-minute long videos from a cheesemaker that made hyperlocal cheese with 100 local cows without any refrigeration or transportation. And he knew the names of all the cows and he convinced the farmers to stop cutting off the horns of the cows, to a Japanese architect called Hirata-san who would design sculptures out of solar panels. And he was at Salone del Mobile in Milan, to this amazing innovation expert who advised like Brad Pitt on his whole sustainability portfolio, or the architect that actually designed the amazing hospital for Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. So this, like, you know, we got connected with all these incredible humans and basically asked them what they're up to and tried to communicate their stories and tried to find ways of communicating solutions. Mm. And you know what? We made some very, like, professional videos, but the barrier there was the distribution. Like, the videos are sitting around and no one's ever seen them, you know what I mean? It's like,
are they online?
They're online, they're like on a website, they're somewhere on YouTube, and probably, like, you know, some of them got a couple of thousand hits or something, but nothing major. In some ways, maybe I was the worst person in it as well, because, you know, like, they wanted me to be the face of it. And so I had to kind of, you know, be the interviewer, and I don't know that I was that great at it. But anyway, this was all me learning different things along the way. And so amongst all of this, I ended up getting an interview with Julian Assange. And basically through AOL somehow had this interview with Julian Assange, and people who voted for the thing basically, and people who won a vote got to meet him in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So that was me. I ended up putting a question on and asking him, you know, if it's not the technical and financial barriers, what's the best way to power the entire world using only renewables, basically? And so, yeah, I won it, got to go hang out with him. We spent 2 hours talking about theory of change. And probably the most potent thing that he said to me was, you know, because he did, some people don't like him, some people think he's amazing, but like him or not, he did some pretty amazing things. And it's like, he swung a vote in Kenya from a really corrupt politician to the, like, the really honest politician because of a document he released. He took down corrupt banks in Iceland, you know. And I said to him, what's the deal? Like, what is, what's the most powerful way to create change? And he said, you know, it's, he needed a certain, with WikiLeaks, he needed a certain influence with the mass population to be behind what they were doing. But it wasn't actually all of those people fully understanding information. He said it was about influencing the influencers. And it was about, he said, the fastest way to create change is, there's probably, you know, there might be some topic that you're interested in. There might be 3 or 4 people that might actually be responsible for making that decision. And it's about influencing them. So getting the masses to support something, to then get in the ear of the person who's actually going to make the decision, to realize that the popular vote is to do that. I need to do that. So that changed my thinking. And then the next day I got a phone call from Vivian Westwood's office, and they, because she knew Dylan Assange somehow, they had a renewable energy crowdfunding platform, and they asked us to throw this solar powered party in London. So we, that was another thing that Off the Grid did. So we ended up totally morphing it to like this fashionista crew. We got Kate Moss's husband, Jamie Hintz, to come along and DJ at it. We got Hemsley and Hemsley, these celebrity chefs, to come along and cater it. We basically tried to like influence all these influential people in London. We tried to target, you know, this like full on celebrity list of people to try and get these 400 extremely famous people to come onto this party. It's probably the worst party I've ever thrown. You know, like it was a really weird mix between Suits and basically everyone from Vivian Westwood's office and like a whole bunch of like fashion crew. And it just felt really uncomfortable, and it wasn't, didn't have a heart and a soul. And it just like, it was kind of another failure, you know what I mean? It was like one of the big opportunities that we had, and it was like a huge fuck up.
Yeah, so celebrity encounters need to be peppering an event. I think when pepper is the overwhelming flavor of any dish, it's foul.
Yeah, exactly. It was a foul party. And like someone actually, the other day I saw them, and they said, you know, you need to apologize to me for inviting me to that party.
I'm waiting for your official apology.
Yeah, so that was funny. So
Kate Moss has barely returned your phone calls ever since.
Oh, yeah. No, she never made it. We thought we were getting her to come along, but she never made it. So anyway, that's one of those things, like, you know, that's helped us over the years to try and get people on board, is it sounds cool that we've done this party with Vivian Westwood, but actually it was the worst, one of the worst things that we've ever done, do you know what I mean? But anyway, so around this time, I started to get back into consulting as well. We started working with a ski resort in Switzerland again, doing this like master plan, and then my...
So when you're consulting, you are advising them as they're building about how, or renovating, as to how to do it in the most sustainable way?
So, yeah. So to give you an example with the ski resort, they knew me as a creative. So they came to me and asked me to help them with an animation to explain their vision for sustainability. And I was like, oh, what's your vision? You know, like, what is it? And they were like, oh, you know, we're doing all these things. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, where are you going? What are you doing? Like, what, you know, what's the vision? And they didn't really know. And so I was like, okay, we need to do a technical and a financial strategy to work out where you're going for, say, energy, water, waste, food, transport. Let's find out the most pragmatic path that you can follow from now into the future. And then once we know what you need to do, then let's work out what we want to actually communicate to people. Let's not just...
And you're like the video guy that's turned up.
Yeah.
Who coincidentally happens to know how to solve the biggest problem that they've ever looked.
And so they were like, yeah, okay, sounds cool. Let's do it. So we basically did, we worked out like they were spending $3 million a year on electricity. We worked out, you know, what everything that they were spending. And then we were like, boom, let's see what we can do with all this money and basically see how we can transform this thing. So we came up with a strategy for 100% renewables, making it water neutral, zero waste, like this really cool food strategy and a really cool transport strategy for like a whole mountain. So the dude who owns this, like the hotel at the ski resort, he owns the whole mountain. He's got like a I mean, like a 100-year lease on the whole mountain. Mm. He owns the lift company. They own 25 restaurants, 5 hotels. And he's a really cool, open-minded guy. So they were probably the first ski resort in Europe to embrace snowboarding. So they worked out that if they integrated freestyle into their business, they could actually be profitable, you know? Like, it wasn't just some fun thing to have snow parks and stuff like that. It was like, it brought people. They created these amazing indoor skate parks with trampolines and, you know, like, and all like a freestyle academy where they could train up, you know, young snowboarders and freestylers. And the parents that brought them had cash, and
billionaires' kids need to learn to skate, snowboard as well.
And so they were kind of this radical, open-minded ski resort where they were like, you know what, let's do things different and let's make it work, basically. So they came to me and they said, all right, let's go crazy, Ross. And so we just basically came up with a like really radical strategy, and they're just slowly implementing it. And so, yeah, so now they've got the technical financial side, and then we made a number of videos to help them explain what they're doing. And, you know, that all of that, you know, it was really a good example for me to show the technical financial and the human side and how important all of that feeling, human communication, all of the things that are not necessarily so easy to quantify and so easy to kind of like measure. Well, you can, but I didn't really know how to. And they helped, you know, like, and so that was cool. So anyway, at this point in time, my brother calls me and he's like, I'm having a kid, man. And I was like, I want to get out. I was living in Berlin. So I was like, I want to get out of Berlin. I'm either going to go to London or Melbourne. And then I was like, I'll go to Melbourne because my brother's there and he's having a kid. So moved back to Melbourne 4 years ago and sort of started to consolidate all the things that I've been doing over the years, because really it was a random eclectic selection of things, and I was on this mission to do this like, you know, big campaign around the world, and then I was kind of like, what am I actually doing, you know? And this was like part of the real honesty of like having no fucking idea what you're doing but trying really hard and trying to make it up as you go. And I realized that I'd been spending all these years trying to get sponsors to fund a campaign. But really what I knew best from my days as an engineer was consulting. So I flipped it and I was like, you know what, screw getting one company or lots of companies to sponsor one campaign. I'm going to be one business and I'm going to work with lots of different clients to help them to achieve self-sufficiency. And it can either be on a creative level or on a technical level. And so I kind of, you know, had this idea of how I could do a consultancy and a creative agency at the same time. So when I moved back, I decided I'm not working with assholes anymore. I'm only going to work with people I love.
No asshole policy.
No asshole policy. That was one rule. The other one was...
Which is such a luxury, isn't it? You know, like when I started my own thing, one of the first things I wanted to do was not have to work with dickheads.
Yeah.
Because I've had great jobs that have been ruined by bad company in the past.
Well, this was the thing, is that the first thing I realized was it doesn't matter how hard I go, it doesn't matter how good my report is, it doesn't matter how good my video is, it doesn't matter how good the party is, it doesn't matter how good anything we do is, if we're not working with the right people, it's not going to happen, you know? So I just realized it's, you know, it's not, and this was the thing, it was about kind of being selective about what I wanted to do, because time's short, you know? We've got to change this environmental situation. I was like, I can't just fluff around anymore, I'm wasting my time. So I kind of honed in. One rule was no more assholes. The other rule was only work with people that really want to do the maximum. So environmentally, with particularly in architecture, people just want to do the absolute minimum, and they get someone like me in to help them do the minimum. And I was like, as soon as people are like that, I'm not interested. So we basically say to people, if you want someone to do the minimum, go elsewhere. What we do is we do maximum performance, but we'll help you do it in the most cost-effective way possible. Which kind of speaks to their language, and that helps, and that's good. And that's generally what we're trying to do. It's like, why would I tell someone to advise someone to do that I wouldn't spend my own money on? You know what I mean? So this was the sort of technical financial side. Creatively, to begin with, I didn't really, like, I kind of to hone in on Australia and the architecture scene again, I just had to kind of go back to just being more a consultant and people not really seeing how you can be creative in that space. So simultaneously, I decided my one creative project would be this party. And it was me and AL were living together again. And I said, hey, AL, let's do a project together. And we talked about a whole bunch of different options. We decided the party was the one. Yeah, so we looked at a whole, I think we came up with like 17 different ideas for business concepts, right? And we just were like, you know what? The party's got a background. And you know what's weird? People like it, you know? Like we can try and come up with something new and try and test something new and stuff, but there was a certain magic and luck that came with that party idea that just people connected with and it felt right. So we thought, all right, let's, actually what we wanted to do was, it's funny that the way you introduced it was, you know, on the outside, it seemed like it was supported by council, but originally we went to City of Yarra and we said, hey, we know you guys are trying to go zero carbon by 2030. We want to help. And they were like, they wouldn't even give us a permit to do a street party. Do you know what I mean? So we basically just were like, we wanted to rock up, take over a street, build a solar system, throw a kick-ass techno party. And we actually wanted it to be like a live vote. You know, we wanted people to basically, we wanted to film it live and basically get, throw out t-shirts into the crowd. And every time people would donate, say, we got $1,000 in, you know, then a t-shirt would go out to the crowd and we'd have 1,000 people there. And we wanted to try and raise like $1 million in a day for a solar system. And basically the people watching online would see the crowd go from black to yellow or something, you know what I mean?
Great idea.
And so we thought, let's just do something fun to like make it fun, but really we're acknowledging that the people that are there is a small like influence in a sense. It's only 1,000 people and like the amount of people you can influence through an event like that is so much more through PR, media, blah, 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 you know what it's like. So we were like, how do, you know, what should we do? So we, they kept on rejecting us. And then, and at this stage we'd met some like lovely crew from Melbourne who wanted to help us throw the party. So basically ended up finding the site at Acca. Like basically they were like, we're looking through so many different places trying to find different things. And ended up finding the site and...
That's the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art, which is South Bank, just next to the Malt House, for those that are familiar with that part of Melbourne.
Exactly. And so, yeah, so Bryce found that place and we ended up... it was perfect, you know. It was this big, rusted, contemporary piece of architecture. It set a different precedence for, like, for environmental events, you know. It wasn't... We never wanted it to be some hippie fest because we weren't trying to preach to the converted. Do you know what I mean? It was like, we need, the kind of philosophy behind the event is that if you think about a bell curve population, like it's hard on a podcast, but I'll try and go with that. It's like, if you think about a bell curve population, you've got 90%, I mean, you've got like 10% of people are leaders environmentally, this bell curve, 10% of people are leaders, 10% of people are laggers. And you've got the 80% in the middle, you know, of the general population. The leaders, they're the converted. There's no point preaching to the converted. By the way, the leaders, they're engaged and they're aware. The laggers, they're the skeptics, okay? They don't, you know, they're climate skeptics and they're, you know, like, they're hard work. What's the point in putting your effort towards trying to change them?
They're disengaged and they're unaware.
Disengaged, unaware. The centre of the population, they're engaged, but they're unaware.
They're swing voters.
So thus awareness, right? And I didn't like awareness because it sounds like it goes into that environmental box. And so I didn't ever want to talk about it as awareness. But at the end of the day, it's sort of awareness, you know?
Yeah, isn't that our forefathers, God bless them, have done such a shit job of PRing these really important ideas?
Mm.
It's like Christianity. You know, Christ the man, what a legend. Christianity as a franchise, what a shithouse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. It feels like sustainability became religion and people have to like go to church if, you know, it's like, you know, be perfect. And we wanted to, we wanted to make it accessible for everyone, right? And it's like bring anyone along and make it accessible to anyone. And this sort of big chunk of the population environmentally, but musically, we wanted it to be aspirational. All right. So it's like we wanted the leaders on the music scene. We didn't want it to be cheesy because we need this to be a progressive concept. We need it to be forward thinking and aspirational. And it's the future. It's creative. It's futuristic. It's inevitable. It's happening. Like, let's fucking get on with it. And so that different bell curve for music, we were targeting those, the forward thinking crew. So we basically wanted to get a lovely, diverse mix of really nice tunes and to get people to come along and just have a fun time. okay? And it was like, sorry, you can
say. No, something. I was about to say, I just have a little moment about that, the idea of what progressive music is for the uninitiated. You know, there, I go to Melbourne now after living in Sydney for 6 years, and when I go out, I listen to music and it sounds like I'm listening to something from the future. Because in order for something to exist in Sydney, it has to be commercial by nature, because there are so few opportunities for people to have a live music venue with a license, that in order to ensure that you can stay afloat, you have to have the most commercial product possible so that you can actually exist. It's a tragic state of affairs. If you are an up and coming junior DJ who is trying to play something that is remotely left of center or up and coming or from some random back tributary of SoundCloud, there's nowhere for you to play. No one will hire you. You don't get a space. Meanwhile, in Melbourne, by comparison, every single laneway off a laneway off a laneway has so many bars with so many opportunities to hear so many different types of music, and everyone has an opinion, and it's such cultural currency to want to talk about music and to talk about progressive ideas in through the culture. Definitely. That if you host a space that is playing something that people haven't heard before, it's a reason to turn up.
Yeah.
But in Sydney, if there's something that hasn't already had a proven track record, like a fucking top 40 hit, then it doesn't get any airtime.
Totally. Exactly. And that was why also it felt right going to Melbourne, but also probably why the concept worked for us in Melbourne as well, is like, I'm from Adelaide, and people in Adelaide, they don't like unusual things. You know, like, people in Adelaide are quite conservative, and the people put down things that are different. And it's lovely for me to be in Melbourne because it's so refreshing, because people love weird shit. It's like, people need it, actually.
There is value, there is cultural currency in having an access to weird shit.
Yeah.
Like, if you tell someone that you've just consumed a form of culture that they've never heard of before,
it's like, I need it.
They are very jealous.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so... So in a sense, we basically just got some scaffolding, set up a solar system, pulled out a battery bank, and threw down a party that no one really had any expectation of. Like, people just didn't really know what to think. I don't think anyone really thought we were going to pull it off, and I think everyone probably thought the power was going to run out and whatever. And it just turned out to be a really lovely atmosphere. You know, it was the first time we did it zero waste.
Was that the one that I came to, 2016?
No, this was 2015. Ah. So the first one was 2015, and we basically probably got 1,000 people there. Benoffi, Tornado Wallace, Suzanne, this kind of lineup, and it was Average Rap Band. They were like, it was cool, it was really fun. And the lineup was really diverse. So we weren't trying to target a niche crew in Melbourne. We wanted a progressive crew, but we wanted them mixed up, you know? It's like, we don't want you guys feeling too comfortable in your own little bubble.
Great.
Come together and be
mush up against someone who's from a different niche.
Yeah, like, you know, let's get the kind of like, just, you know, the techno kids with the hip hop kids, and everyone come together and have fun time together, and like, cut your crap, you know, cut your bullshit about this sort of image that you have, and just like, come together for something more important, basically. But not in like a, you know, like this almighty religious way, in a just down to earth way of like, guys, let's fucking get our shit together, you know what I mean? And so, and it worked, you know, it kind of felt, that was really nice to achieve the feeling that we would set out to achieve, you know what I mean? And that was like, sort of felt great. We lost money on it, that felt bad, but it was such a euphoric feeling to be there and see everyone experiencing that emotion that we wanted to create, you know, like, it was such an amazing feeling. So we kept on doing it. And the second year we did it, because we lost money in the first year, we actually, as a like way of just trying to not lose so much money in the second year, we decided we'd bring in a conference, because we thought, you know what? Last year, people didn't rock up till like 3 or 4 o'clock, and it was like, started at midday and it closed at 10. And we're like, we spent like 6 months planning this thing, and people don't even rock up till 3 or 4. And we thought, all right, let's just throw a conference in the morning and we'd turn it into a party in the afternoon. And at first, everyone was kind of like, what are you talking about, man? You're crazy. And it was probably, it felt like a dumb idea at the time, maybe in some ways, but it kind of felt like people were asking for information. And I was always reluctant at first because we didn't want it to be preachy and telling people what to do and like talks and things. But somehow we felt like people wanted it. You know, there were people were going, hey, but we want to know more. How did the power thing work? Where did that come from? Where do I buy that? How do I do this? How do I live zero waste? What am I, you know, they wanted to know everything. And because we weren't preachy, we probably didn't give them enough. And so it was lovely. We kind of just were like, okay, if that's what you want, well, then this year we'll give you more. So we then did eight or nine until one. We did talks and they were super cash, but super great people. Like, you know, the president of the Institute of Architects, we got the, you know, like Yoast, the zero waste expert. We got all these amazing people to come along and speak. And it just set this even better tone for like the afternoon because people were energized with all these solutions. And it wasn't this pompous. The other thing is we got a weird diverse mix of people to the conference. So normally a conference is a whole bunch of suits and it costs like $400 to $1,000 to go to. We were charging like $30 or $40 to come to our party. And you had anyone. You had mums, suits, hippies, techno kids, anybody, you know? Like, and everyone wanted, it was like, you know, at 8:30 in the morning, we had like 400 people there for this conference. And we were like, wow, this is amazing. And we didn't know, you know, what time anyone's gonna get there. People sort of liked, a lot of people liked the conference more than the party. And that felt really nice. We were like, great. So, but also what it did is had this amazing spin-off effect of people kind of, not everyone stayed the whole day. Some people came and left. Other people didn't come to the beginning and they came later. But there was this sort of continuation of information that went through.
And just conversation starters. Because everyone's been educated, so they want to discuss.
Everyone, like, and that was the thing, without us telling, you know, we didn't tell anyone what to talk about or ask anyone what to talk about, but it was just, you walk through and I just hear these, like, riveting conversations of, like, whoa, oh my God, like, you know, hey, have you ever thought about this? And why don't we do this? And how do we change this? And it felt like, you know, the feedback we got from a lot of people was that they really wanted to do more and it helped them kind of, like, learn about it. And you know, like, we weren't telling anyone to do anything. We were just rocking up, throwing a party that we thought was cool, and in a sense creating an example. Like, so that's sort of, and that was our thinking along the way as well, was we were not exactly sure what we were doing along the way. And we were like, in the end we realized it comes back to cities, you know, like for me it did anyway. And it was like, I tried to convince developers to make cities self-sufficient. It's like, it doesn't work. We need to show people, we need to give them examples. And creativity is such a beautiful way of connecting people with solutions. So we created a little mock-up of the future of cities. And like, and that was it. It was like, I don't have enough money to be a developer and build my dream hotel or build this city block or, you know, all these things, but I can rustle up enough cash to throw a party, you know what I mean? So basically the third year we decided to bring in even more tech. So we got like a solar fridge in. We built a huge structure out of wood and solar panels. We got in solar cookers. We, like, the conference ended up going 9 till 5. We got composting toilets. Like, slowly we're trying to bring in more and more technology that we're actually acknowledging this is how a city needs to operate in the future, actually. Like, right now, our infrastructure's backwards and it needs to change. And the only way, in my opinion, that it's going to change is through people actually connecting with solutions through creativity. And also to set in some context, you know, like, UN have just come out and said we've got 12 years to transform, to take some serious action on climate change. Otherwise, like, see you later, human existence, right? So when you think about it, countries are not agile enough. Like, there's a lot of people feeling this way. It's like countries are moving too slow. They can't all agree on any climate policy. And we're all sitting around waiting for that. We're sitting on our hands waiting for China and America to agree on what's happening so we can all do something and then all do it together. Fuck that. Let's transform cities now. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's what we've got to do is that we, like, so cities can be totally self-sufficient, energy, water, waste, and financially viably. And like, but the big barrier, and a lot of them are trying to do it, you know, like there's a thing called the Clinton Climate Coalition, basically, or something like this, but there's C40. It's like there were 40 cities around the world that all agreed to go to zero carbon by, I think, 2030 or 2050. It's a big target. None of them have actually got the steps on, or very few of them have actually got the implementation plan of here's what steps we need to do it. And so,
it's like anyone who sets a lofty goal for themselves and just says, like, I'm going to release a feature film by 2020. But unless there is some practical application towards the steps that of what the daily version exactly. of that looks like, then 2020 will come and you'll be disappointed in yourself.
Exactly. And so this is where shit gets exciting for us, is that party is starting to allow us to, like, connect the cities. So City of Melbourne approached us for creative visioning, and we've basically been like, so my view at the moment is, so our next event, we're going to power on food waste, because solar, everyone knows about, batteries, everyone knows about, the waste to energy power plants, not enough people know about them, and it needs a good rebranding because it sounds pretty ugly, you know what I mean? So we basically found a container crate out in, I think it's in Ballarat, and it basically takes about 40 kgs of food a day, and where you can turn into gas. We want to fill up a balloon with gas over like 3 months and in one day deflate it to run the gas engine, and that'll power our event. And it's a demonstration project to show people what is possible. Does it smell? Does it work? You know, like, this is the thing. People don't think these things work until they see them.
And they need the practical application of it. I think the reason why the conference part of Off the Grid was so engaging is because of all the different speakers coming at it from different angles and different areas of the practical application of eco-awareness, the average person can see how it applies to their lives.
Exactly.
Because people don't, it's not that they don't care if they can't see how it how it matters to them and how it changes their life. It's just really hard to imagine. It's Columbus arriving and indigenous people not seeing the ships, because if you can't, you can literally be looking at the solution directly in front of you, but you can't see it if you have never understood it before.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I mean, I totally agree. My view is that everyone wants to do something, pretty much. Basically, everyone wants to do something, and most people just don't know what to do. And it's like, it's really nice to be able to give people some easy stuff to just say, like, here's what we should do, and all work together on that. And it's like, I've personally, one of the most fun things about the event that's happened in time is the waste thing. And that's because you wouldn't picture how a city could operate zero waste right now. Like, you look at all the laneways, you look at all the bins, all of the plastic, all of the food waste, everything. It's like, oh my God, it's so complex. How can you do it? The way we design the waste infrastructure there, it's like, we don't give people a choice. Take the thinking away. The only thing that you can produce as waste at our event is something that's organic or biodegradable. There's nothing recyclable. It's either reusable, and you don't even necessarily, like, you know, there's reusable cups and things like that, but like everything's basically, there's only one bin and it's an organic bin. And so that's intentional because we wanted it to be as simple as possible. Sometimes people make people think and make it hard work for them. But this was the thing. It was like kind of wrapping up in a nice feeling and a creative experience, all these really important solutions that are kind of like deep inside of it, but trying to not also jam it down people's throats. And like, you know, we give it if they need it, but I think people also, no one likes being told what to do, you know what I mean? People want, if they ask, then they're keen, but they don't want to be, you don't want to rock up to a party and people are like, put that thing in that thing, put that thing in that thing. It's like, oh man, I just want to hit the dance floor, give me a break, you know what I mean?
So it's such a, well, if someone, I'm always wondering about the practical applications of things that we can do. I mean, you even mentioned that in order for you to get to Sydney, you took the train, because even though you were coming up to consult on, you know, on something that's environmentally aware, it is contradictory then for you to fly. So I imagine that you are aware, it sounds to me like you know that flying is catastrophic for the environment. What are other ways in which simple things that people can do just differently, if they were aware of the difference, they'd be able to do it if they or inspired to do so?
It's a good question. I mean, it's sort of, I find there's a long list, right? And I feel like it's, and I'm on that personal journey myself, you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people, the fear with it is that you feel like you have to be perfect or something. And I'm totally imperfect.
Like, I think there's not enough good role models, because those who are doing it really thoroughly are maybe doing it militantly so, and therefore they're presenting a level of an image of perfection that's really unattainable for the average person.
I think that's the same deal. It's not accessible for normal people. And it's like,
what's the simplest, dumbest thing that anyone can do that just allows them to make less waste, or to be able to do to consume more consciously?
Yeah. So I'll give you a few. Like, firstly, it's good to switch over to renewable energy at home. That isn't hard. You know what I mean? It's worth just like getting online, having a look at a few different places, and just making sure you're making the right decision. But switch over to green power. Food waste, big one. Like, basically, it's like, I could go on about it for ages, but keep your food. 50% of a city's waste is food, and we throw that in landfill. Makes methane. It's 28 to 40 times worse as a greenhouse gas emission than carbon dioxide. And we have to fill up plastic bags and drive them in trucks to get rid of the stuff. Compost it. Get worm farms. Like, cities should have anaerobic digesters in them, but, like, that's coming. But basically, I mean, ride a bike, you know what I mean? It's like, don't take a car, shop locally, you know, like shop, like, you know, buy without plastic. I basically like have a sweet grandma little like wooden basket, basically like a, and I go to the Whole Foods store and I buy all of my produce without any plastic, you know what I mean? I use a whole bunch of jars and I take different bags, and it's like, I'm not perfect. I'm not living zero waste, but I'm trying to produce as little waste as I possibly can. I have a worm farm at home and I basically put my organic waste in there. I try not to buy any new clothes, and if I do buy new clothes, I try and educate myself on where they all come from. We've got like way more clothes in the world than we need to, you know, like to get new stuff. I get it. Sometimes it's nice to have a new shirt or a new this and that, but like, buy it from someone good. Understand it. Every choice you make in life is a proxy vote for the future you want to see in the world. So, you know, when you're buying from fast fashion, you're supporting fast fashion. Fuck that. Go buy it from either some like great person that's produced it locally, or buy it secondhand.
I like to end by asking people, if I was to check in with you in a year's time and ask you about a project that you've been working on and have completed, what is something that you would have liked to have done by this time next year?
I want to be working with like the 10 most important cities in the world on their self-sufficiency strategies. We're like, basically our goal is to be the world's best environmental consultancy and creative agency within 5 years. And to do that, we want to be the best in Australia in 2 years. And I personally think we need to keep working with architecture. It's important, but time's short. UN said we've got 12 years. So it's like, we actually need to come up with like really clear strategies in cities and start implementing it. And I don't know, this is my next step that I don't know how to do, is I've just got to knock on the door of cities and they're all just going to laugh at me, and I'm just going to keep doing it until someone agrees. And then hopefully we've just, you know, like, I was just in Mexico City and we were just hustling to try and meet with the right people in Mexico City to pitch that. Sometimes people treat you more seriously in other countries than they do in your own, unfortunately. But I just met with the company that did the LA River Revitalization Project, which is maybe the biggest infrastructure project in LA. So we're trying to get in with Los Angeles at the moment. And, you know, like, different things like this, we're trying to somehow hustle to get in on just going big and going as hard as possible. Because, man, it's like, the thing for me is we're not trying to do it to make money, you know? Like, we're trying to do it for human existence. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, let's just go as hard as possible and as quick as possible.
Time's running out.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ross.
Thanks, Dan.